Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You're listening to True Crime Feed. Welcome to True Crime Feed. I'm your host, Angela Ferrari, reviewing the best true crime podcasts from the past decade with a teensy bit of humor, plus my top three true crime picks of the week. Today on the docket, a show from the archives I think you will really enjoy. Let's discuss the case for Killing on the Cape from ABC in 2020. Here's a synopsis from the show page. It was a crime that rocked an idyllic seaside town in Cape Cod. The 2002 murder of Krista Worthington, found stabbed to death with her 2-year-old daughter unharmed at her side. What came next was a 3-year search for her killer that would involve unorthodox steps by police, a lengthy list of potential suspects, and an entire town under suspicion. And to enhance your listening experience, go to thetruecrimefeed.com and sign up for my newsletter where I curate visual aids to accompany the show. Here you will see photos of Krista Worthington and the many, many potential suspects in her death. The Killing on the Cape podcast series originally dropped back in 2017, and it was a typical dry toast ABC 2020 report. I've listened to so many incredible shows in the interim, podcasts that far exceed the quality of this series, and yet, 7 years later, I still think about this case regularly. Partially because this case was so baffling, and usually when I finish a series, you know, I might not have all the answers, but that doesn't keep me from forming a strong opinion. But after tuning into this show, I walked away feeling as clueless as Cher Horowitz realizing she had romantic feelings for her stepbrother, Paul Rudd. And unlike Paul Rudd, I've matured over the years, acquiring my 10,000 hours of listening to true crime podcast level mastery, or my doctorate in podology, if you will. And now I thought it might behoove me to go back in time and revisit the case that's perplexed me so much, perhaps come to a more definitive conclusion, now that I have my distinguished true crime credentials. And maybe as you listen along, you'll come to the same epiphanies too. Or perhaps you'll think my final conclusions are more absurd than Cher Horowitz ending up with her stepbrother at the end of the movie Clueless and everyone seeming totally fine with it. We shall see when we get to the other side. And now it's time to pack our bags because we're going on a charming New England coastal getaway to Truro, Cape Cod, circa 2002. Oof, but I forgot, it's January, so pack a parka and some extra long underwears. If you look at a map of the Cape, Truro is the last stop before you hit the northernmost tip of Provincetown. At the height of summer, the population of Truro hits upwards of 20,000 residents. But come winter, 90% of those homes are empty. Only a few thousand residents are brave enough to withstand the freezing cold coastal winters. Most of the year-rounders are working-class folks, and there's a few city transplants who have come to prefer the isolation. That was Krista Worthington. She had escaped the rat race of New York City for simple coastal living, And in 2002, she was living with her 2-year-old daughter in their sleepy little cottage at 50 Depot Road in Truro. But this quaint little coastal town is about to feel a whole lot like Cabot Cove in a real-life episode of Murder, She Wrote. Only Jessica Fletcher would be spitting out her English tea after encountering some of the more baffling details of this case. Which brings us to the horrible morning of Sunday, January 6th, 2002. Dispatch gets a call that Krista's body had been discovered on the floor of her kitchen. She had been stabbed to death, and her little 2-year-old daughter, Ava, was physically unharmed but clearly traumatized, wearing a soiled diaper and clinging to her mother's body. This is one of the saddest, most disturbing scenes you could imagine anywhere, but unfathomable for a place like Truro. The news sent waves up and down the Cape. 46-year-old former fashion writer, now single mother, Krista Worthington murdered? Who in this sleepy little seaside village could do such a thing? Well, to answer that, first we need to get to know Krista. She came from a prominent family. The Worthingtons' roots and wealth date back 4 generations in the Truro and Boston area. Krista was born in 1956. She was the only child of Christopher Toppy Worthington, a Harvard-educated lawyer, and her mother, Gloria Saunders, worked as an artist. Krista grew up in the Boston suburb of Hingham, Mass., and she summered at the Cape, where her family owned several properties. And when I say several, I mean a block of 10 houses in a row. And as a kid, she could walk a few blocks away to her great-grandparents' house. After high school, Krista Worthington attended Vassar, where she studied writing. She spent the next few decades living a very glamorous life as a fashion writer for Cosmo, Harper's Bazaar, and Elle magazine. She lived in New York and eventually Paris, rubbing shoulders with celebrities at parties, even having a fling with Vanderbilt heir Stan Stokowski. Just a fabulous time. It all sounded very Sex in the City. Krista was beautiful, intelligent, fashionable, and a truly gifted writer. But she was not so great at the dating game. Her friends recalled her misfortunes in that arena. Lots of drama and volatile relationships. Eventually, Krista became disillusioned with the fast pace and often vapid lifestyle. So she traded in her designer shoes and handbags for beach sandals and canvas totes, relocating to a family-owned cottage on the beach of Truro, down the street from the place she would eventually meet her demise. At this time, she was in her early 40s, and Krista was feeling like she missed out on her chance of settling down with a stable partner and starting a family. Until one day, she calls the local harbor master on some guys who are docking and unloading their boats near her cottage. So shellfish constable Tony Jacket shows up. He is tall, dark, and handsome, tan skin, a mop of curly black hair. He's kind-hearted and very charismatic. Krista took a liking to him immediately. Things start out innocent at first. At one point, Tony rollerblades by her house, and Krista waves him down to share a cup of tea. Eventually, one thing leads to another, but I mean, who can resist a constable on rollerblades? Unlike the men Krista had previously dated, Tony was the salt-of-the-earth, working-class kind of guy, the grandson of a Portuguese harpoon fisherman. She wrote about Tony in her diary, saying, quote,
"If there was a sweeter person on earth between the hours of 8 and 9:15, I would not believe it. Tony became tender, and we were made new, spellbound. I love him."
They carried on a 2-year romance, and then at the age of 43, Krista became pregnant. This came as a shock to both her and Tony. But yet, this was what Krista Worthington had always wanted. The only problem? Tony was married. Yeah, he'd been married for like 26 years to his wife Susan, and they had 6 kids together and lived in the village over. Tony knew what he was doing was wrong, but Krista always said she couldn't have kids, so they never used protection. But now Tony Jacket was in a jam worse than Cape Cod traffic on Route 6 during high season. Ugh, that's a rough one, man. Krista insisted on having the child and promised to keep Tony's secret. At first, anyway. But things grew volatile once baby Ava was born. Krista was threatening Tony, wanting him to put Ava on his insurance and pay for child support. And if not, she was going to expose him as the father. Fast forward to after her death, investigators found a 5-page letter Krista wrote to Tony's wife Susan, but never sent. The tone of the letter was nasty. It went into graphic detail about their sexual escapades, then closed out the letter with, quote,
"Happy anniversary."
And even though she never delivered the letter, it shows Krista's mindset during that time, writing in her diary,
"The emptiness around me, miles and miles of it, while my lover lies with his wife."
Yeah, it was a bad sitch for everyone. Tony was trying to cover up the fact that his wages were being garnished, and rumors were spreading all around town. Ava was already 2 years old. He knew he could not keep this secret forever. So he finally confessed to his wife. Susan understandably had a meltdown. She ran to her father's house and was pounding at the door, screaming for him to answer. And when he did, she told him what happened.
"Tony had an affair and fathered a child with his mistress."
Susan's father replied,
"Christ, is that all?"
And that answer apparently calmed Susan down. She spent a few weeks processing and eventually decided she wanted to stay together with Tony and embrace Ava into the family. Krista began bringing Ava around and joining the Jackets for family meals. Susan and Krista even became friends. Maybe unconventional, but somehow they made this situation work. Things could have continued on. One big, happy, blended family. But 8 months after Tony's secret came out, Krista Worthington was dead. And because of their tumultuous history, Tony Jacket was immediately a suspect. And though Krista's body was found Sunday, January 6th, her time of death could have happened somewhere during the previous 36 hours. Tony gave his alibi for most of the weekend. On Friday, he and Susan went to the movies to see the Royal Tenenbaums. Then on Saturday, they went to the movies again and saw A Beautiful Mind. And then on Sunday, Tony was watching the Patriots football game. Checks out to me, but not to the cops. Instead of ruling him out, Tony became a person of interest while the authorities continued to gather information. Their investigation only led to more questions and a growing pool of suspects. So let's start with this bizarre crime scene first. At the time of her death, Krista had upgraded her living quarters to 50 Depot Road after she inherited the property from her mother dying from cancer in 1999. So this is where the murder occurred. And again, we have a small coastal town where the rate is next to zero, so the cops didn't have a ton of experience with securing a crime scene. Her house was a mess to begin with, a pile of dirty dishes in the sink, clothes and toys everywhere, because, you know, Krista was a single mom with a 2-year-old. But the messiness only added to the chaos. Krista's body was discovered laying on her back. She was nude from the waist down. And someone responding to the crime scene early on haphazardly covered her body with a brown blanket. She had been stabbed through the lung, and there was dried blood around her. Her body was fairly cold and stiff when it was discovered. Because of the cold winter conditions, medical examiners couldn't narrow down a definitive time of death. They collected 9 different fingerprints and partial palm prints around the crime scene. MEs recovered DNA in the form of semen and saliva from Krista Worthington's body. There were signs of forced entry on her front door, and Krista's cordless phone was missing, although her cell phone was present and the number 9 had been pressed. The knife murder weapon was never recovered. And between paramedics and neighbors and police, at least 14 people walked through the crime scene. Certainly not perfect conditions, but hopefully something we can work with. Now, for the potential suspects. Judging by the crime scene description, I was thinking this could have been a random stranger. So I was shocked when her own father, Topper, became a person of interest. Krista was in the midst of a big blowout with her dad at the time of her death. He was in a relationship with a sex worker 40 years his junior, who also had a substance abuse problem. Her name was Elizabeth Porter. Topper was spending lots of money supporting Elizabeth, including paying for her apartment. Krista was concerned about Elizabeth, who had made headlines in 1999 for testifying in the famous Dr. Dirks Greiner case. Dr. Greiner was trying to maintain his innocence in the stabbing death of his wife, May, and Elizabeth Porter testified that Dr. Greiner had paid her for sex 2 times in the month leading up to the death, which poked holes in the doctor's claim of a happy monogamous marriage. So anyway, Krista's concerned about her father's relationship with Elizabeth, believing he was putting himself at the risk of squandering the family fortune by being mixed up with this person. Both Krista and Elizabeth made statements that they wanted each other out of the picture. The weekend of Krista's death, Elizabeth was shacked up at her place with a guy named Edward Hall, who called out sick from work that weekend. He claimed it was because he was partying with Elizabeth. So police arrested Porter and Hall on unrelated drug charges and also brought Topper in for questioning. All three submitted to a polygraph examination, and all three tests were inconclusive. I guess the theory here is that Elizabeth Porter, Edward Hall, and or Papa Topper Worthington may have had something to do with Krista's death. But what about that DNA, though? Back in 2017, when I first listened to this, I always believed that DNA evidence was a mic drop end-all be-all in solving a case. But since this show's original airing, I have heard dozens of cases where the DNA evidence was misinterpreted, contaminated, or even downright tampered with. So not always as reliable as I once believed. This case especially, the DNA evidence was controversial, starting with the very collection itself, because 3 years after Krista's death went by without an arrest, investigators pulled a dragnet, calling for voluntary DNA samples from all male residents of Truro. They set up a location near the post office and collected over 300 swab samples and made national headlines in the process. This is wild to me for so many reasons. First off, the lab was so backed up that they haven't even finished testing the DNA of the first round of suspects, and now they were collecting even more samples. Number two, kinda seems like a major invasion of privacy. Like, how long are they able to legally keep your DNA on file? Like, forever? Can it be used against you in future unrelated crimes? Like, how does that all work? And then number three, what murderer is going to submit to a voluntary DNA collection? This just seems so unnecessary and dumb. And Murder, She Wrote's Jessica Fletcher agrees.
This is more witless than a waterproof teabag.
I mean, obviously I get they want to catch Krista's killer at all costs, but this particular method seems super problematic. Another year goes by and the lab finally gets a match. Not from anybody who participated in that big public dragnet, mind you, but from someone who volunteered his DNA a year earlier after police first questioned him. A man named Christopher McCowan. Bingo. We've got him, right? Maybe? Chris McCowan was not a Truro local. He was a transplant from Key West. He happened to also be one of the only black men living in the area year-round. Chris worked as a garbage collector, and Krista Worthington lived on his route. He was questioned by police a few times. The second time around, he voluntarily gave a DNA sample. According to Chris, he was out collecting trash on Thursday, January 3rd, just a few days before Krista's body was found. He claims Krista waved him down to ask about collecting her Christmas tree, so he went into the house to see her tree still decorated in the middle of the living room, and then he called his boss from Krista's phone to ask about removing the tree. Chris's boss, Don Horton, corroborates this part of the story, and there was evidence that a phone call was made from Krista's house to the Cape Cod disposal. Chris McCowan then claims that one thing led to another, and he and Krista had consensual sex. That's Chris McCowan's explanation for why they found traces of his semen inside Krista. And to be fair, the semen was degraded when it was discovered, which means it could have been a few days old. Investigators also had another suspect high on their list, and this was Krista Worthington's ex-boyfriend, Tim Arnold. He had been dating Krista on and off for a year. They had a very tumultuous relationship, but Tim managed to become very close with Krista's daughter, Ava. Little Ava would even call him Tim Mom. For a time, Tim lived at 50 Depot Road with Krista and Ava, but he was suffering from a neurological condition where he would see double vision, and it made it so he couldn't drive and could easily fall down. The condition was getting worse, and Krista, who was fiercely protected of Ava, was worried that Tim was going to accidentally drop her or fall on top of her. She wanted Tim out of the house, and this was devastating for him. After months of drama, blow-ups over his health, their sex life, and money, they finally broke up for good, although Tim Arnold admitted he wasn't handling things very well. And to top it off, the weekend of her death, he left a series of fairly unhinged-sounding voicemails on her answering machine. Oh, and also, what I didn't tell you is that Tim Arnold was the person who discovered Krista Worthington's body. Tim claimed that the morning of January 6th, Tim's father picked him up so he could do laundry over at his place and watch the Patriots game together, because this is New England and that's everyone's alibi for Sundays. Tim Arnold's father happened to live just down the road from Krista Worthington, so Tim figured while he was in the area, he'd have his father drive him over to Krista's house so he could return a flashlight that he had borrowed from her. And that's when he discovered Krista's dead body and little baby Ava clinging to her mother. He picks up Ava and rushes her into the car. Then his father drives them back to his house 100 yards away, where Tim Arnold calls 911. Later on, MEs would discover Tim Arnold's semen on a blanket that was used to cover Krista's body. But again, that sample was also degraded and easily excused because he also once lived there. Tim was questioned the day Krista's body was discovered, then again 3 days later, and then silence until 6 months later. Tim was having some mental health problems. He learned he was a suspect and that police wanted to speak with him again. He checked himself into the psych wing of the local hospital, and under these conditions, the cops thought it was a good idea to do an interrogation. That's right, they questioned him in the psych wing of a hospital. Tim had hired a lawyer at this point, but his lawyer was not present for the interrogation. And the police were laying it on thick, saying that Tim's previous statements and actions were consistent with someone involved in the murder. But despite his fragile state, Tim Arnold maintained his innocence, and the cops didn't have enough to make an arrest. I know. I told you this case is baffling, and it's made so much worse by the manner in which police went about their investigation. Instead of thoroughly collecting and testing crime scene evidence, these guys thought it was a better idea to interrogate someone in a psych ward. Murder, She Wrote's Jessica Fletcher would say,
It appears to me that the detective in charge of this case got into the cooking sherry.
Indeed, Jessica. It's truly outlandish. So, at this point, for potential suspects, we have Krista's baby's father, Constable Tony Jacket, her own father, Toppy Worthington, her garbage collector, Chris McCowan, and Krista's ex-boyfriend, Tim Arnold. On April 15th, 2005, 3 years after Krista Worthington's murder, an arrest was made. Who do you think it was? Christopher McCowan was arrested and taken into police barracks. This was a year after he had voluntarily given his DNA sample. He was questioned for 6 hours without a lawyer, while high on Percocets, cocaine, and weed. And that whole story about him walking into Krista's house to see the Christmas tree and then engaging in consensual sex was not the first story he told police. First, he told them he didn't know Krista at all. Then he made a weird confession saying that he was out that Friday night with this sketchy friend slash amateur white rapper named Jeremy Frazier, who was performing at a place called the Juice Bar that night. And there's actual video of this event and Jeremy Frazier's dumb rapping. Oh, it's so bad, you guys. I'd rather listen to that Macklemore thrift store track on repeat than these bozos. Chris claims that he and his friends got super wasted at the Juice Bar and then went out to a party where a fight broke out. And then he and Jeremy Shady Frazier went over to Krista's, where he claims he hooked up with her and that Jeremy tried to rob her and then stabbed her to death. I think that's the gist of his confession, but I don't know for sure because none of it was recorded and the entire 6-hour interview only yielded a 26-page report. The police tracked down Jeremy Frazier, and he denied ever going over to Krista's house or having any involvement in her killing, but also he was blacked out drunk that night. We also learn a weird tidbit that I'm still perplexed by. For some reason, the state police called Jeremy that Friday night, I guess technically Saturday morning, on January 5th at 12:03 a.m. We still don't have any answers as to why the cops were calling him that night. Investigators dig more into Chris's background, learning he suffered from a severe seizure disorder as a child and as a result has an IQ of 78. He also has a few criminal charges against him, one for grand theft auto, and multiple restraining orders against him. Though some of these women came forward in his defense after his arrest to say those restraining orders were made for reasons other than physical violence, but still not a good look. Chris McCowan goes on trial in 2006 for the murder of Krista Worthington, and if you thought the investigation was rough, wait till you get to these court proceedings. First off, jury selection in general, it's always a fickle pickle. This case, prosecutors and defense made clear distinctions. The defense wanted working class and or black jurors, thinking they'd be more favorable to Chris. Prosecutors wanted more affluent WASPs that would sympathize more with Krista. Most self-employed folks can't fulfill jury duty, so the defense had a hard time in that department, but they selected one black woman to sit on the jury named Roshana Bahana. More on her later, but first, the trial. In addition to the murder charges, they added an armed robbery charge and a rape charge. The original medical examiner who actually performed Krista's autopsy was out sick, so another dude was filling in, which wasn't ideal. And again, they were unable to determine an exact time of death, so we basically have a 36-hour window from Friday night, the 4th of January, to Sunday, the morning of the 6th. Although the defense had their own lividity and rigor mortis experts who felt confident that Krista's time of death at the earliest was 8 a.m. on that Saturday morning. Both timelines rule out Krista being murdered on that Thursday, the day Chris claimed his garbage route took him to Krista's house where she invited him in to look at the Christmas tree and he called his boss from her house. It is possible, though, that Chris went back to the house sometime during the weekend and killed her. The prosecution's major evidence against Chris are his statements to the police and his DNA. You remember that Chris first told police he didn't know Krista, then he said he saw her on the roof but never went into the house, then he admitted to being at her house and having consensual sex, then there was the whole story where he claimed that he went there with amateur rapper Jeremy Frazier, who tried to rob Krista, ended up killing her, and Chris helped him cover the whole thing up. The prosecution puts Frazier on the stand to refute some of Chris's statements and then put the sole blame on Chris McCowan. Frazier's performance on the witness stand, though, was worse than his amateur rap performance at the Juice Bar. Yeah. At first, he claimed he put on an amazing show at the bar, then went to a party with Chris and his other friend Sean. Then Chris went off on his own after a fight broke out. And Jeremy's alibi was that he spent the rest of the evening over at his friend Sean's dad's house. Under cross-examination, defense attorney Bob George points out that Jeremy first claimed to police that he blacked out and had no memory of that night. So how does he know what happened now? And Jeremy Fraser replies,
"Because the police fed me the information."
Again, this was a witness for the prosecution. Even Jessica Fletcher thinks that relying on Chris McCowan's statement is pretty weak tea.
Weak tea indeed, Angela. I find it akin to making love in a canoe.
Oh, you mean f***ing near water.
Well, perhaps one could say it like that.
And as if you thought this story couldn't get more off the rails, there's also an eyewitness, a neighbor of Krista's who walked by her house the same time every Saturday. And this witness distinctly remembers seeing a man in a dark vehicle pulling out of Krista's driveway and peeling off down the street. The witness claimed the man was not black, but had tan olive skin, and police did no follow-up into this lead. So let's move on to the DNA. Again, this is the most scathing evidence against Chris McCowan. And the rape charge was added after his arrest because I guess no one believed a wealthy upper-class white woman would ever consensually have sex with a working-class black garbage collector. However, before his arrest, the consensus was that there was no physical signs of rape. The prosecution had Chris McCowan's semen and traces of his saliva DNA collected from Krista's body. There was, however, no other physical evidence connecting him to the crime. There were unidentified fingerprints, palm prints, hairs, footprints, and then, most shockingly of all, DNA under Krista's fingernails from three separate individuals, none of which matched Chris, and they are still unknown. What the DNA evidence tells us for sure is that Chris McCowan had sex with Krista Worthington. The prosecution and the defense, they make their closing arguments, and then the jury deliberates. Chris McCowan is found guilty on all three charges: armed burglary, aggravated rape, and first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Shortly after sentencing, defense attorney Bob George gets a call from juror Roshena Bahana, and then a few other jurors came forward as well, stating they heard racial comments being made by some of the other jurors, and these statements may have prevented Chris McCowan from getting a fair trial. So these allegations are taken to the state Supreme Court. Roshena Bahana claimed during deliberations she had a whiteboard up and was reviewing the details, and then a fellow juror named Marla George made disparaging statements that included the words "big black man" and "small white woman." And this resulted in a very heated shouting match. Bahana accused George of being a racist. Then another juror named Eric Gomes was allegedly overheard whispering, quote, "That's why I don't like black people, because she acts that way," referring to Bahana. The whole thing was a sloppy mess. And the thing is, even if jurors don't say these things out loud, you still never know if they think this way. That's why I hope the robots will eventually take over jury duty. In the end, the claims of racial bias were ruled unfounded by Judge Gary Nickerson, and Chris's sentencing stands. In 2010, he was denied an appeal for a new trial, so he's been in jail since 2006. Krista Worthington has now been gone for over 20 years, and Ava has had to grow up without her mother. Tony Jacket and his wife Susan petitioned for full custody of Ava, but in the end, she was raised by Krista's close friend, Amira Chase. I don't know who killed Krista Worthington. It could have been Chris McCowan. But I know for sure the investigators and the prosecution did not build a strong enough case to prove this man guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore failed Krista Worthington. It would be so much easier if we really were on an episode of Murder, She Wrote and Jessica Fletcher could swoop in and just solve the case. But there are no easy solutions to the multitude of problems in our real-world criminal justice system. However, if I did have a fantasy wish list for this case, it would include 1, outsourcing DNA testing to private laboratories to help keep up with the rising demand and reduce the backlog. That way we wouldn't have a suspect give a sample and then have to wait a full year for the test to come back, and they wouldn't have plenty of time to peace out and ghost us. 2 on my fantasy list, eliminate the Reed interrogation technique. This is the technique cops still commonly use to interrogate suspects based on the presumption of guilt. There's an updated method that's been adopted by England, growing in Australia, Norway, and the Netherlands, that's called the PEACE model. And I know it sounds super touchy-feely, Miss Lippy, but it's just an acronym. The PEACE method is a 5-stage information-gathering approach through cognitive interviewing. So basically, you let them tell their story completely, uninterrupted. Then you present them with any factual inconsistencies or contradictions. Interrogators avoid using deceptive practices and avoid forcing guilty confessions. And I get it, this method would be a bummer if you like to play the bad cop, but I think it's a better alternative to interrogating someone in a psych ward of a hospital and or coercing a confession out of someone while they're high on coke and Percocets and already have an IQ under 80. Number 3 on my wish list, I want AI jury robots, y'all. This is kind of a joke, but I honestly don't know any other good alternatives. I mean, I guess exclusive judge bench trials, maybe? It's a slippery slope, but the jury system is in major need of reforming. But even with my extensive pedigree in true crime podology, I still don't have any great solutions for this one. So that's where I Lansbury today, after revisiting the series Killing on the Cape. And looking forward to consuming my next crime adventure, a Murder, She Wrote crossover with Tom Selleck's Magnum P.I. in Hawaii. Trading in my hot tea for a hottie. If you catch my drift, a ta-ta for now. Alrighty, I am dying to know your opinions about this case. Honestly, I wish I could just hand the mic over to you, but you know, the whole pesky space-time continuum thing. Instead, feel free to email me directly at angela@thetruecrimefeed.com, or even better, join the True Crime Feed Facebook discussion group. Keep an open mind and be kind to fellow True Crime Feed friends. Stay tuned till after the break to hear my top 3 podcast power ranking of the week. Hey you. I'm so glad we found each other and get to share our special love for true crime podcasts. I don't ever want you to miss out on a wild story. That would be a crime in itself. So be sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on your podcast app and share your favorite episode with a friend so the next time you see each other, you can splurge about your latest true crime obsession. Thanks for spreading the word, and now back to the show. And we are back. Before we start the ranking, kind of a frustrating week. I actually don't have any complete misses this week, but I have these pods in my queue that are overall good shows, but they've hit some doldrums. The worst offender was Murder 101. The latest 2 episodes were a slog, and it's still not over. I'm trying so hard to continue rooting for this show, but the editors have done Murder 101 such a disservice for not trimming it down. Hopefully the last episode finishes the series strong. The last episode of Varmintown was also fine. I gave it a B grade. I appreciate the closure and the updates, but I was hoping for a little more of that razzle-dazzle I've come to expect from Kyle MacLachlan and Joshua Davis. So, feeling a little meh about those two. However, I do have 4 shows in my top this week that I am jazzed about. So, allow me to present the 4 shows currently trending that I think are worth a listen. I present to you this week's podcast power ranking.
4, 3, 2, 1.
At the number 4 spot, we have Hello, John Doe. Here's a reminder from the show page. At age 45, Steve Patterson made a shocking online discovery, his own missing persons page. Desperate to uncover why he had been included on the list, Steve called Todd Matthews, a missing persons investigator, in search of answers. Together, Todd and Steve discover a sordid family past that includes long-lost relatives, kidnappings, and murders. Hello, John Doe is a winding, poignant tale that explores what it means to be lost and found. WTF, this case is so crazy that I totally forgot there was another missing child from the same birth family. All the way to episode 7, and we are still learning tons of new information. This case, though, it's so sad and dark, But then narrator Todd Matthews will say something like,
"The investigator was wigglier than a worm in hot ash."
And makes me smile. The show continues to deliver primo investigation and narration on Hello, John Doe. At the number three spot, we have media pressure. Here's a summary from the show page. It's been 20 years since 21-year-old nursing student Maura Murray disappeared without a trace on February 9th, 2004. Yet countless questions remain, and her family continues to fight for resolution. Her mysterious disappearance is a story that strangers have told hundreds of times. But absent in the story you've heard are the voices of those who knew Maura, those closest to the investigation. Not anymore. That is a wrap on media pressure. This show had one of the best closing episodes I've ever heard on a podcast. Oh yeah, I have some similar feelings to the way I felt about the investigation into the Krista Worthington case. I am dumbfounded by the New Hampshire police's decisions pretty much every step of the way. Their actions would not only have Jessica Fletcher spitting out her tea, but I'm pretty sure she'd slam her mug on the ground too. If you want some material to rage out with, don't miss Media Pressure. At the number two spot, we have Three. Here's a rundown from the show page. After midnight on July 6, 2012, three teenage girls walked into the thick Appalachian woods somewhere along the Mason-Dixon County line. Hours later, under the glow of a nearly full moon, only two walked out. What happened to Skylar Neese has become Gothic American folklore, the odd girl out in a vicious teenage triangle. But in the 10 years since this fateful night beneath the West Virginia stars, a fuller portrait of what happened has emerged. I was putting this one off for a binge listen, and I listened to the first six episodes in one rainy morning, and now I'm chomping at the bit for the rest of the show to be released. It's so addictive. Teenage girls, man, yikes. The social media of it all is wild, and I am shocked how candid that deputy was with his interviews. This case is an example of some first-class investigating, but that's about the only solace I have when tuning in to the disturbing case of Three. And at the number one spot, we have Search Engine. And PJ Vogt's investigation into who's behind those scammy text messages we've all been getting. Here's a rundown from the episode. "Hi David, I'm Vicky Ho. Don't you remember me?" An investigative reporter travels halfway around the world to find out who is sending him random wrong number texts and why. After you hear this story, you'll never look at these messages the same way again. Yeah, the synopsis kind of says it all. You will never see these messages the same way again. And by the end, I was actually feeling so terrible for the actual people who are sending these. This reporting is a must listen, so don't miss this episode of Search Engine titled, "Who's Behind Those Scammy Text Messages We've All Been Getting?" Find out next week who will be in the number one spot, and let me know what trending shows are in your top three. I'll meet you back here next week to dust off another superb true crime show from the archive for your next feeding fix. That's all for today's true crime feed. Don't forget to sign up for my weekly newsletter where I post links to my top threes, sometimes four, favorite shows of the week, and bring you fabulous visual aids for every episode. Be sure to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to join the conversation. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and tell your fellow partners in crime to tune in to True Crime Feed. Thanks for riding along and allowing me to be your audio accomplice. Join me next week for another feeding.